Welcome to Hedge Fund Tips with Tom Hayes. I'm Tom Hayes, and this is your 233rd videocast podcast for the week ending April 5th, 2024. We're live from Miami, Florida this week. Got a lot of great stuff to share with you. We'll start with the family, but we've got to get right down to business because there's just too much to cover. Action-packed this week. Here's a little Easter action. We spread out the eggs in the front yard. Yes, we're still at it. As a matter of fact, Annabelle said to Caitlin, I know it's you, but I still want eggs. So how's that for straightforward? I wonder where she gets that from. So there they are in front of the house. This was a brunch we went to. Awesome time. And there's Mimi down there with her bunny ears. Moving right along, we've got this week I was in golf camp. And this was absolutely amazing. This is Andy Plummer and Mike Bennett. You know I've referenced them in the past. They're down here at Turnberry in Aventura, which is basically Miami, and JW Marriott Resort and Spa. Absolutely incredible 3 days. And I really came to this. I thought I came in good shape from hitting on the simulator all winter. I was completely bass ackwards, to put it mildly. I was reverse pivoting. I was bending forward, a complete train wreck. And honestly, it took them 2 days to straighten me out. And then by the third day, I was puring. And then I was really nervous the first 2 days because I had to play Thursday at Pine Tree with some really good golfers. And by the grace of God and their persistence and professionalism and expertise, there are no, I mean, by the way, they're under NDAs, but the number of top pros that use them, that you see on TV every week is staggering. And this is a way, this is leverage way to shortcut any of you who are already in golf or even starting in golf. If you want the best of the best and you want to save 3 or 4 years of trial and error and a lot of money and a lot of heartache, just go see these guys, Mike Bennett, Andy Plummer, absolutely amazing. So I'll just quickly share, you know, they got me looking like this, which actually looks like a golfer. That's with my buddy Mike, and that's with Andy. These guys are the best of the best. I'm really grateful the progress that it made in such a short day, few days. And, you know, this was a camp, so I met some great guys there. One's going to get me on Bethpage Black, which is pretty exciting. I played that once before. That's the book they wrote. That's Mike on the cover. There's an iguana. And this is my friend Ryan Perna, who invited us to Pine Tree on Thursday. By the way, the simple thing, if you're interested in getting in touch with Andy Plummer or Mike Bennett, the co-founders of the Stack and Tilt Method, you should go to stackandtilt.com. You can reach out to them. I think they work amazingly together because Andy is so detailed and scientific about the arc and all these things that you need to have that fundamental background. And then Mike comes in and says, Tom, just do this, this, and this. And then all of a sudden, after I hear Mike, I understand everything that Andy said. And because Andy said it, it makes what Mike says so much easier to implement. So it's really just a phenomenal thing. Now, Ryan, I'm going to try to get him on the podcast at some point. His group is called vanbridge.com. Ryan Pern is the guy. They specialize in these private placement life insurance policies. And this is a fantastic setup that you can look into if you're ultra high net worth, 5, 10, 20 plus million that you have to put to work, that you want to put to work within a life insurance policy that you can compound the capital tax sheltered and pick your manager. So there's a little friction, but it's definitely worth looking into because at the right amount of assets, it's really advantageous to at least explore it. Hopefully I'll be able to get him on the podcast to talk about it because I know there's a lot of ultra high net worth people that would like something like that. That's that. So moving along here, I think I got that. And then a couple pictures just to give you an idea of some of the things we worked on. I came into this, I don't know what the hell I was thinking. I was rolling my risk. I was laying off the club. I mean, this is ridiculous. What was I fishing? And then they got me straightened out. We got the club face closed. We got it, pointing straight up in a reasonable way. This was even more upright by the end of the thing and by the time I was playing. And then, basic stuff. Okay, I put some of the wrong pictures here, but like, look at this. Look at how this was laid off for all you golfers. I mean, that's unacceptable. What am I fishing out to right field? How am I going to even hit the ball? Like, it's miraculous that I was doing it. And then they got this face square. They got me taking it straight back up through the middle of the bicep and just puring it. So very, very grateful to those guys. Can't say enough. Want to thank Onward and Upward here. Want to thank. Oh, speaking of which, the girls swimming. Let's pull that up here. Don't know where that got lost in the mix here. Here we go. A lot of stuff going on this week, guys. Between all right, this was in last weekend. The girls swam at Eastern Zone Short Course Championship in Webster, New York. I was up there, if you remember. Mimi was the only 11-year-old in her events to make finals every night, and she swam all personal bests. She's now the fastest 11-year-old in the state in, no, in the region. It was regionals. In 200 back and 500 free. That's amazing. And then 9-year-old Annabelle is the 2024 10 and under Eastern Zone champ. Oh, no, that's correct about the state thing with Mimi. For 200 back and 500 free. 9-year-old Annabelle is the 2024 10 and under Eastern Zone champion in 50 back. And she and Mimi will both swim this summer in Virginia for the state of Connecticut against the other states in the Eastern Zone Long Course Champion. So very, very proud of them. There's Mimi and Annabelle. There's Annabelle on the podium next to Vanessa Delev, who's fantastic. She's a year older. She's 10. And then some more photos. So they're getting used to time on the podium, which is a good thing. All right, moving to it. I want to thank Julia Shapiro for putting me in her article on The Hill this week. Want to thank Reuters for including me in their article last week, and wanted to pull up the AAII sentiment survey for this week, which was again a little bit extreme, a little bit overdone. And not coming down yet. We'll see how that persists. We're going to talk about some of that this week. I didn't get to put it in the article last week because I had to write it the night before. Flow Show from Bank of America Global Fund Manager. I like some of these themes that they're talking about here. I believe, yep, this is Hartnett. He's one of the best in the business in terms of just delivering good data. Thanks to my buddy, you know who you are, for sending these over. So, couple of things here. First off, he's pointing to this fish mouth, and we've seen a lot of fish mouths, whether it's Chinese equities, and sooner or later these mouths all close. But the one that he's covering here is that gold is discounting a collapse in real rates. So you see that this is highly correlated. You saw this type of discount at the GFC lows, and then sure enough, real rates collapse as gold went up. So I think we're going to see that coming to a theater near you. We covered in the article of the week, which we're going to review here, the extreme bearish to extreme bullish indicator. Their B of A bull bear indicator is still right in the middle, and there's some reasons for that, which we're going to cover as well. Tech versus commodities hasn't been this stretched since March of 2000. That doesn't mean we're going to have a tech collapse, but I think like the last month, we are going to see continued a little bit of hesitation and underperformance of tech relative to some of the other groups that can start to shine. This is interesting chart. China high yield real estate bonds are says receding the debt implosion that everyone's been scared of. That risk is receding as bonds start to bottom, like you saw off the 2009 lows. That's a positive thing to see. Biggest upside potential is laggards. If ISM picks up, which it is turning, And laggards just basically means the ones that have underperformed are now, the last shall be first, which we're a big fan of, and position four, which is going to be positive. And that's it from, I think that's it from this report. It's a lot we went through. You can kind of see the total returns year to date. Gold is the top performer. Commodities are starting to do well. We have that expressed through Comstock, which is starting to come off the mat. Just the beginning days in our view. We like to see that Jerry Jones came in with another 100 million, pari passu at the same level that you're able to buy in the market in the eights. I think now, is it in the nines now? And we'll see how the rest of this plays out. These REITs are going to move as the Fed gets in. It's interesting. The market was, up, down, up today. Yesterday, Kashkari said, I could see a scenario where we have no cuts. The market collapsed in late afternoon. And then Logan comes out and says, we can't wait until inflation reaches 2% to cut rates, which Powell has been saying for some time. So they continue to talk out of both mouths. The algorithms continue to trade around it. And that's why if you pay attention to the short-term noise, you're going to get your head ripped off. You just got to buy good businesses, cash-generative businesses that are temporarily impaired, that are recovering, and hold tight through the volatility, through the noise, and don't try to guess what the next FOMC member is going to come out and say in the headlines. This is also from Bank of America. The buy side is far from bullish by beta cyclical exposure. We're going to cover that. No bid for financials, especially banks. This is critically important because they have such a weighting in the small cap index, which we believe is going to start to outperform. And I like to see these extremes, quote, no bids, quote, uninvestable, quote, quote, quote. You've been around long enough, you know that's how we think. And someone else's liquidation is our opportunity. So I think that's going to be our new saying. We've got a lot of sayings. The secret to happiness is low expectations. Bezos always said, your margin is my opportunity. I think our new saying is, your liquidation is our buying opportunity. Your forced liquidation is our buying opportunity. Maybe that'll one day will be a quote. Tom Hayes, we'll see. So that's that. And then few buy or hold deep value investors left. These are all the things that you see when things inflect. We covered the reasons why the financial conditions index, the new financial conditions index last week, why that's that regime is changing, and so on and so forth. So long only funds are beta neutral, so they're not excessively bullish, which is why we have the longer term view that this continues for the next couple of years with a short term pause. We'll see if we get the pause or we don't get the pause, but you can see exposure to financials very light versus history, basically the lowest level for long only funds since the great financial crisis. Long only bank exposure just off of all time lows, which were achieved during the SVB crisis and almost mirrored the great financial crisis. I mean, can you imagine that people are more bearish on banks today than when the economy almost flew off the cliff in 2008, 2009? It's unreal. And I'm not sure why that is. It could be that the new crop of PMs is kind of grew up on social media and instant feedback, and they're more emotional to short-term moves. I don't know, but it's not even apples to bananas. Like, you can't even make the comparison as to what we're dealing with the slow burn through some pockets of commercial real estate relative to what we were dealing for completely going off the cliff in 2008, 2009, and they were close. Value is now 56% underweight. This is what you always see. Relative exposure to energy plus banks, value is below average here. So over and over, you see where the opportunity is going to be. Or you chase and you try to say, oh, wow, this is going from the lower left to the upper right. I'll just chase it up after it's up 100 or 200% and hope that I get the last 10% before and sell to the last sucker before it collapses. Good luck with that. That's like a gambling analysis and mindset. And over time, even if you win short term, the casino will take all your chips back. And usually, when you get lucky like that, chasing the herd, you get overconfident because you think there was some skill based in your luck, and then you bet bigger, and that's when they clean you out. So, you know, if you've been with us for a little while, we are the antithesis of that view. We buy quality when it's out of favor, when no one wants it, and we just hold through the short term noise. It recovers, then people get excited, and then we start laying off, and we'll do that over and over. We love to do it. We know it works. We sleep like a baby at night. And that's what we try to impart on this and hopefully be helpful to many people that maybe either are getting the wrong advice or fighting their own internal instincts. I mean, you know, human fear and greed has been the same since the beginning of time. And we try to just objectively have rational thought and processes and frameworks that keep us away. And yes, we'll miss some of these runners that, you know, would be 1 out of 1,000, but we don't get caught in the 999 out of 1,000 that have the same characteristics that wind up goose eggs. We deal in the realm of high probabilistic, high quality businesses. So the S&P starting to see a little bit of momentum roll over on a weekly basis. We'll see if we get some follow through. We got a little bounce back rally today off of those comments. Let's see how it goes into the close. This trend line was broken this week, so we should probably go back up and retest it. Where are we at now? 52. Maybe we overtake it, and it was a fake out yesterday. We're going to find out in the next few sessions. The bond yield rally looks like it's coming to at or near a close here. There's a lot of resistance at this level. This is RBC Sloomer again. Thanks to my buddy over there. You know who you are. The dollar bounced off this level. We think yields are going to bounce off their level here. Commodities are breaking out. We're going to talk about why in the article of the week. This is from Seth Goldman. What he's talking about here is the McClellan oscillator. This is one of the number of oscillators we reference. He's saying it's getting closer to oversold. You could see a bounce. I think that's objectively correct. We take into combination quite a few indicators in our analysis there. I mean, at the end of the day, what's been uncanny during this period of rally, and we've been there have been literally 3 to 5 people, and we've referenced them over the last year and a half. We were a very minority group, whether it was Ryan Dietrich, Seth Golden, Tom Hayes, Tom Lee. There weren't many of them that got very bullish October 2022, stayed bullish March of 2023, stayed during the SVP, stayed bullish during October 2023 when everyone was puking. And now we've gotten we put that 2% hedge on in recent weeks. We'll see if that pays out or not. I mean, look, we're 98% long. We're happy if the market keeps pushing higher. But we play the probabilities, and we were bullish when no one else was. That worked. Now we're a little cautious when no one else is. Whether that works or not, you know, we win. If it doesn't work, we win more over the 8-month time frame if it does work, and we'll find out. Seth Golden, retail X auto spending surged 5.2% year on year, boosted by Good Friday. So that's consumers not weakening, not under stress, not without greatest cash hoard in history, despite what economists opine. I'm going to point to another chart that shows that companies are actually in the same cash position. So for the bulls, here's your fodder. Also, US rail traffic is up. That's a key leading indicator that we look at from time to time. Seth posted the chart here, which is very nice to see. Also, he posted on China PMI, which we've referenced in a number of the articles. But here's a nice chart talking about the effect that the stimulus is starting to have. China's targeted stimulus seems to be working, as evidenced by a sustained manufacturing expansion. As a matter of fact, I put out a tweet over the weekend that I think many of you will find funny. Some of you won't, but you need to lighten up. Basically, it was on Easter, and what I said was, On Easter, I said two miracles in one day, both Jesus and the Chinese economy rising from the dead. So that was the day that China put out their factory activity expands for the first time in 6 months. The manufacturing PMI is turning, and that's a big indicator of good things to come. So we're excited on that front. This is from Carl Quintanilla through Financial Times. Global supply of equity shrinks at fastest pace in decades. I think that's something that's critical, is that the demand for equities is increasing and the supply has decreased. And that's setting the stage in why we continue to own Citi and Bank of America, despite the fact that they've had decent rebounds, is because we don't want to miss the second two phases of this cycle, which are number one, and that's related to the cash on corporate balance sheets, is going to be an unprecedented M&A cycle you're going to start to see. That's going to be banking fees. And number two, and that's animal spirits in the market. You've already started to see it in biotech. And number two is the IPO game is going to be back better than ever. So Citi and Bank of America are going to benefit huge. And we also want the basket of regional stocks and small caps because everyone hates them, and they'll work them their way through what is perceived to be a monstrous commercial real estate, which will probably prove to be a slow burn commercial real estate. And deposit flight has stopped. So all of that's good. Now, Ryan Dietrich posted this basically saying that 10 plus 10% in the first quarter is rare for the S&P. When it happens, strength begets more strength. You know, a quarter later, on average, you're up on average 0.4%. Biggest drawdown was 12% in 1975. But a year later, you're up 12%. So I could definitely see us up a year from now, April 2025, up 12%. I think from these levels, I do think there's going to be a detour in the interim. Probably not as aggressive a detour as people are going to think it's going to be when it starts, but that'll just create some opportunity to put capital to work. Moving along here, got that. Corporate cash levels, highest level. This is from Carl Quintanilla through WinSmart. So you can see here, corporations have a huge amount of cash for M&A and buybacks and to return capital and dividends, and we're going to start to see more and more of that. And then finally, moving on to some of the articles of the week, we've got China's recovery picks up as stimulus measures kick in. So we covered that. You saw it in manufacturing. China fintech Ant Group targets global growth after Jack Ma's control exit so that he could appease the government, which is a very positive development. We own a third of that through our ownership in Alibaba. The other thing that was interesting about Alibaba is there's a great interview on YouTube. You can just type in Joe Tsai, Tsai, co-founder and chair of Alibaba in good company. It's from Norges, Norges Bank Investment Management. They own 2% of Alibaba. And he's basically saying, good luck if you're betting against China or Alibaba. The future is bright. The other thing that I liked that I didn't know about Joe Tsai was that he himself was an athlete growing up. So he's got a competitive streak about him, which is comforting. He's not just like, you know, sitting back and hoping things get better. You can tell he's got the fire in his belly, and he realizes that you know, where they made the mistakes, what they've done to rectify it, how they're going to move forward, how they're going to take advantage of all the opportunities with compute demand, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So for 30 minutes, I was going to cut it into this, but then I was like, you know, it's you can go view that on your own. And then Xi and Biden had a 2-hour phone call. That's good. At least they're communicating again. That's good follow through from San Francisco. And then Yellen went over to China to talk some more. Talk, 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 talk is better than no talk, no talk, no talk. Taobao to launch several biz-friendly initiatives for all platform merchants starting in April. That goes to what Joe Tsai was talking about in that great interview. Yellen is back in China. We covered that. Ray Dalio, this is very interesting. Ray's been going to China for like 40 years now. And he says, now is the time to buy quote unquote cheap Chinese stocks as Beijing works to revive the economy. So this is a big deal. We agree. Okay. And he spent quite a bit of time in China. So it's kind of nice to see more and more people coming around besides Michael Burry and a few others. David Tepper, of course, has a big position in Alibaba and many, many others that you know. Alibaba ramps up share buybacks. They bought like 4.8 billion shares in the first 3 months of this year. They still have 31 billion available on their current buyback authorization. Good to see. Investors are unwinding the buy India, sell China stocks trade. We agree. You can see the data now. So the skew is against India and for China. And I think that's correct for the next 3 to 5 years. I think it will be incorrect 5 years from now. It should be the opposite. But remember, all the AMAs for the last, 3, 4 months have been people asking, like, why don't we buy India? Why don't we buy India after it's already run? And the answer is because how you make money in this business is, believe it or not, buy low and sell high. Everyone knows that. Very few people do that. And that's a whole hour we could do on behavioral finance, but we're not going to do that because you can just pick up a book and read about it. Xi's cryptic bond comments hint at PBOC becoming more like the Fed, i.e., quantitative easing. Hint, hint. Very exciting to see. This is great. I put this out on Twitter over the weekend. Very interesting that small cap bears continue to cite the fact that one third of small cap companies are unprofitable. The same scenario before the record run in 2002 to 2007. You saw this peak, and then by 2002, it was coming off the peak, and the biggest run came from 2002 to 2007. And we're seeing the exact same thing. History doesn't repeat, but it does rhyme. US IPO engine looks ready to speed ahead in the second quarter. That's to our point about banks. This is from Scott Granis's blog. He's talking about M2 updates. And as we've talked about in the past, it's still well above trend, which is, why we continue to be long and intermediate term very bullish and 98% fully invested. It's back on trend. It got above trend for a number of years. It's back on trend. So we should see a little bit of hiccups with the absorption process. And then dividend stocks made a comeback in March. That's a theme that we've been talking about for the first quarter. We think that's going to persist and we're going to benefit. There's a great article we posted in our articles of the week, which is Charlie Silk's 100 Bagger. You can Google that. We're not going to have time to go through it in detail today. But basically, I've said it repeatedly in the past, and I think by now, if you've been listening more than 6 months, you'll agree, having seen all the things that we've gone through and benefited from. When you buy high quality assets at low prices, good things happen. And the story of Charlie Silk is that he basically bought this company that was trading at a discount to cash. That doesn't necessarily mean good things if they have a cash burn. But he did the work. He was a retail investor. He did the work. He saw what was happening with the Blockbuster stores during the period. And the long and the short of it is, wow, he got lucky. But he continued to do the work. He had an accounting background. And as everyone was saying, oh, you should take your profits, he held because he continued to look. And that's why people say, like, we know where we intend to exit when we get into a position. But if at the point that it hits our pre-assessed value of intrinsic value where we're willing to lay off, if the fundamentals have gotten much better than we anticipated they would be, we would continue to hold. Ideally, we could hold the business forever in many situations, provided it's not a cyclical business. But this guy made 150 bagger on Blockbuster, and you can read through his story of how he did the initial analysis. It's exactly what we do here every week. And then how he was able to stay with it through the monster run when everyone was bailing out. PayPal stock has been a major laggard. Here's what could get it going. And this analyst from Rawat. Where is he from? Bernstein. Okay, that's a great shop. So what he's basically saying is none of the upside is priced in. All of the new initiatives that are working are not priced in the stock. And he's got a target above 100. I think that's very conservative, but he's doing 12-month targets. We're usually doing 36 to 48 plus month holding periods. And you can read that at MarketWatch. PayPal stock has been a major laggard. Just put it in there and we'll go from there. Next, Ford US EV sales almost doubled in Q1 2024 to over 20,000. So that's bucking the trend. Maybe more of it's migrating from Tesla. I'm not sure about that, but overall automotive sales are crushing it. Alan Wall, want to thank you for sending over this note. We had done a Alan Wallman. We had done a post like this, but this chart, I like these visual charts. It shows US new vehicle sales of 1.455030 units for the month of March represented an increase of 15.5% from February. That's a sequential increase of five, and on top of that, an increase of 5.1% year on year in March. From March 2023. So big jump year on year, huge jump sequentially. And again, when we talked about Cooper Standard in detail a few weeks ago, we said these IHS estimates have been coming in much lower than the actuals. We believe that that's going to happen this year. Here's why we're bullish on Cooper Standard. And we laid out, and so far that's playing out in spades. Fed's Kashkari. This was yesterday, raised the prospect of zero rate cuts, and that tanked the market in the afternoon, along with Biden telling Israel that you have to cease fire if you're going to get any more money. And the market didn't like all of that risk and Iran risk, et cetera. It sold off. And then all you needed was Logan to come out and say, we can't wait to 2% to cut, which we all know, which we've been talking about. And back off to the races for now. Let's see how that plays out. Disney to crack down on password sharing after Bob Iger wins the board fight. Look, a few of you have reached out about Peltz's ideas, which we covered many months ago. By the way, we covered his pitch deck on the podcast video cast. A lot of those are going to wind up being implemented because they're now public, and it was a tight race. This wasn't like a coup for Iger. He won, but if everyone was happy, it wouldn't have even been a fight. So I think a lot of those good ideas are going to be implemented. I think the supporters are going to want to see it, and you see it right the day after, which password sharing was very helpful for Netflix, as many of you know. Earnings season's coming, what the market needs now. So estimates will cover, I think, are plus 3.5%. So that's going to be the next catalyst in the coming weeks. We're going to hear the banks. Strong jobs data suggests Fed can stay patient on inflation. Yes and no. We're going to talk about why they can't stay as patient as they think they can, and the data-dependent narrative is going to quickly morph into stuff like you saw Logan saying that they cannot wait until inflation reaches 2%. Number one, servicing the debt. Number two, liquidity shock could be coming to a theater near you if they're not careful, and they're fully cognizant of that. And Powell has said as much. So, rising sun or falling one, stock marketing and sentiment results. This is the article of the week. Japanese equities have been all the rage in the past couple of years as Bank of Japan agreed to be the unofficial global liquidity provider while the rest of the world tightened policy to arrest inflation. The gig is up. Bank of Japan recently raised rates, ending a prolonged period of negative interest rates in Japan. the global put they provided as a prolific purchaser of domestic and global equities through ETFs is over. Yield curve control is finished as the peg is gone and the mandate to buy unlimited JGBs, Japanese government bonds, is completed. There will no longer be unlimited printing of yen to buy government bonds, Japanese or otherwise. Global central banks have been transparent about their commitment to, quote, global coordination. While Japan played a pivotal role through the West bout with inflation and subsequent aggressive tightening, now that inflation has perked up in Japan and mitigated in the West, the roles are reversed. So BOJ was the backstop for global liquidity when the West had to fight inflation and tighten and be restrictive. Now that inflation is perking up in Japan and mitigating in the West, the ECB and particularly the Fed will now move into a less restrictive, slightly more accommodative stance while Japan moves into a more restrictive stance. What does that imply? Lower dollar, stronger yen. It won't happen overnight. That will be the trend and the regime change, which is going to have a knock-on implication on a multitude of asset classes. So, Japan will be less accommodative, more restrictive, and no longer backstop for bonds and or equities. It is time for Fed, ECB, and others to step up and pick up the slack left from BOJ's removed put. Western central banks will start their cutting easing cycle in coming months, ready or not. With this regime change, Western central banks will have less latitude to remain, quote, data dependent and, quote, waiting for more evidence, end quote. And here's why. Yields are creeping up, and Western governments cannot risk another, quote, liquidity shock or afford to service the massive deficits at high rates, at record all-time debt to GDP. They have to let inflation run hot, 3 to 5%, like they did post-World War II when they brought debt to GDP from 120% down to 60% in a handful of years. And they're going to have to run the same playbook now. Cut and let inflation run a little bit above trend. Commodities, and by the way, they can afford to because wages can grow without inflation getting out of control as productivity gains. Productivity gains are the name of the game here, where they can balance those risks. If productivity wasn't growing and wages were growing, we would have a real 1970s problem that he's referred to with Arthur Burns. The fact that we have increases in productivity means we can get wage growth, we can run inflation a bit above trend to bring down debt to GDP, inflate away some of the debt, which is what governments always do since the beginning of time, in a responsible way, and kind of Goldilocks scenario moving forward if they do it right, which so far they're on the right track. Commodities are starting to sniff out a weaker dollar. Energy's breaking out. Obviously, there was some aspect of that with Iran and the Israel and the geopolitical, but this has been a trend that started since the beginning of the year. Copper breaking out, that's a sign of China's strength, is basically Dr. Copper. And then gold obviously telling the same story. Gold is telling the story not only about weaker dollar, it's also telling the story about reversal of real rates, which we covered earlier today. Is the pause here? We've been talking about an expected healthy pullback from markets in the last few podcast video casts. Is it finally time? So we did break that trend line in like the first week of April, and then it broke down harder yesterday. And now it's probably going to go back up here and retest the bottom of this trend line, and then we'll see if it retakes it, okay, trend back intact, or if we finally get that full 3 to 8% pullback we've been looking for. Let's look at option skew. So what is option skew? This is another indicator of dozens we look at. The skew index is calculated using S&P 500 options that measure tail risk, returns two or more standard deviations from the mean. So in the S&P 500 returns over the next 30 days. So these are people betting on a two standard deviation move a tail risk event in 30 days out, and that's what skew measures. The primary difference between the VIX, which most people are familiar with, and skew is that the VIX is based upon implied volatility around the at-the-money strike price options, while the skew considers the implied volatility of the out-of-the-money strikes, okay? And that's from Investopedia is the source for the definition. And what you can see here, when skew has been elevated the way it has been, and it starts to come down, it implies that the smart money is fully hedged and the demand for two standard deviation tail risk hedges is fulfilled. Okay, so we have, I don't think it's a two standard deviation hedge on, but inside that window, we sell premium against the premium we buy so that we're able to buy closer to the money at lower prices, but we're effectively doing the same thing that the skew implies in a way that, as you can see, you get these elevated things. As that starts to come off the boil, sometimes the market continues to rally and then you get, a more sizable pullback, but not always. Sometimes you can just keep trending higher. Usually you do, even if you continue to trend higher. These bumps here that look like nothing are good 5% pullbacks, 7% pullbacks, and beyond as they come off the boil on these different moves. So, we're prepared for it. We're also 98% long. It is what it is. But these are things we keep an eye on, and that informs our decision, not us guessing about RSIs and how we feel and, when the sun is setting and all this nonsense, but actually things that have some empirical support. Now, when it has been, when this happens, there is a tendency, not a guarantee. You can see some market weakness following these extremes. We shared how we hedged against this risk last week. 3M update, they've completed the spin, which is part of our initial thesis to Solventum. For every 4 shares we owned of 3M, we got 1 share of Solventum. And I want to cut into Jim Cramer did a nice summary of both businesses this week that just in 5 minutes will explain it. And I think you'll find this helpful. So we'll listen in here.
Know that I love breakups. Because when a big company divides itself into smaller, more easily managed outfits, these bite-sized businesses typically do better. And Wall Street laps them up. This week, you got not one, but 2 major breakups, with GE spinning off its power business as an independent company. I told you I like that very much. And then 3M doing the same thing with its healthcare division, and I haven't talked enough about it. So tonight, I want to give you a deep dive in these moves, okay, because it really does matter. I'm going to start with 3M's healthcare business, which began regular way trading was Solventum today, okay? Now, we know 3M's had a tough time for many years now, with the stock steadily falling. In part because of major litigation. They've been eaten alive by forever chemicals and faulty hearing aid lawsuits, the latter being from combat veterans, very sympathetic plaintiffs. Meanwhile, most of their businesses have slowed since 2018. 3M's peaked then. It's been a tough road, okay? But that's not the case for 3M's healthcare unit, which has grown steadily over the past 5 years. In fact, Solventum hasn't had a single year of negative organic revenue growth for the past decade. So the healthcare spin-off is all about freeing this private business from litigation-induced malaise at the rest of the company. So what are you getting with this Solventum? All right, this is a business that did $8.2 billion in revenue last year, split across 4 segments. More than half of its sales came from wound care and surgical solutions last year. Think everything from medical tape to advanced patient monitoring equipment. The rest of the business is split across dental solutions, health information systems, and purification and filtration. These are all high-growth businesses. Management says each of these end markets can grow at a mid- to high single-digit clip going forward. I believe them. Lots of money in these aspects of healthcare, thanks to their aging population, plays right in their wheelhouse. At the same time, Solventum is plenty profitable. I'm telling you, this is interesting. As 3M margins have slid steadily lower for years, the margins of Solventum have held up just fine. Of course, they're going to take a small short-term earnings hit from consolidated costs that come with the breakup, which is typical. There are some additional complications here, though. See, the plan is for Solventum to gradually go from a 3M-affiliated business to a customer that licenses 3M as intellectual property. The parent company isn't just handing over its IP as part of the spinoff. Now, this is not ideal. Solventum frames the split from 3M as a quote, as an opportunity to quote, reposition for growth with a goal of getting its own growth rate in line with the growth of its end markets. Right now, it's lagging the industry. That's an opportunity. They'll look at their portfolio, choose which end markets to exit, which ones to invest further in, and they'll invest more into research and development than they could when they were part of 3M. I like that. Meanwhile, Solventum also plans to look for places to cut costs, and they said they're going to prioritize paying down debt over the first 24 months after the spinoff. I like that, too. I like a clean balance sheet. By the way, as part of the breakup, Solventum's taking on some additional debt in order to pay a dividend to 3M on its way out the door. That's not unusual. Even with that, I think the balance sheet's okay. Not ideal, but it's what happens, okay? Now, we don't even know if Solventum wants to return cash to shareholders via dividend or a buyback, but given the prioritization of debt repayment, I don't expect much on that front for a couple of years. That's a negative. Finally, 3M is only spinning off 80% of Solventum stock to its existing shareholders. They're planning to hold on to a 20% stake, which they want to gradually sell down over the next 5 years. That's a real long-term headwind if you want to own this one. Putting it all together, I more or less like Solventum's core business, but this is not the cleanest of stories, and their guidance for this year makes it clear that 2024 will be a rebuilding year for this newly independent company. Maybe people don't have the patience for that. The good news here, though, is the stock seems super cheap. Solventum traded down to around $69 today, the stock's first day of regular way trading. Given their full-year earnings forecast, that means the stock's only selling for roughly 11 times this year's earnings. That's cheap. By comparison, a company we like very much, Becton Dickinson, it is a similar play in the medical supply space, trades at 19 times this year's earnings estimate. Now, Becton Dickinson does deserve a premium because it has better numbers, but maybe not that much of a premium. However, while I can justify buying Solventum at these levels, you should keep in mind that many of these spinoffs tend to have a rough time in their first few months. Many people who get shares in the spinoff simply don't want them, and they gradually get shaken out over time. Maybe you're in 3M because you like 3M. You don't want a healthcare business. Now, we have seen this happen many times. Look, the old Kellogg. They spun up their cereal business, which is a pretty good business, W.K. Kellogg. Stock initially went from 15 to 10 for only rebounding to nearly 20% as of today. That's good. Danaher, how about this one? They spun off its water business in Veralto. We like that as part of the investing club. Stock initially tumbled, though, from the mid-80s to the mid-60s, but then it climbed all the way back to the high 80s. That's pretty amazing. So if you're inclined to buy Solventum, I recommend buying it gradually over the next 6 months because you'll likely get a better price than you get right now. But what about the former patient? 3M. Well, it's actually more of a parent. All right, now get this. This one's really tricky. And it's one that, like, my dad used to work for 3M, so I'm very sensitive to this. It's one of the greatest stocks, and I always wanted Pop's company to work. I haven't recommended 3M in a very, very long time because I hate playing litigation roulette. People who follow the club know this. But this spinoff of Solventum is part of a broader simplification of cleanup of an effort by the outgoing CEO, Mike Roman. It's a really smart one. Plus, 3M reached some major settlements on both big lawsuits last year, agreeing to pay more than $10 billion to settle the Forever Chemical claims, another $6 billion to settle the faulty earplug lawsuits. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that these issues can be put to bed, but I think the vast bulk of the damage has been contained, albeit at a pretty high cost. Now, if you buy 3M here, you're betting the company can turn things around and they're cost-cutting like crazy. More importantly, you're betting that new management can right the ship. This stock rallied more than 10% a couple of days last month after CEO Mike Roman announced he'd be stepping down, transitioning to executive chairman. Now, clearly Wall Street likes that 3M's bringing in a new leader. They're bringing in this guy, Bill Brown. Now, he did a fantastic job when he was running L3 Harris Technologies, one of the better defense contractors. We've been huge backers of Bill. He's a no-nonsense industrial veteran. I think he's a great choice. I'm still hesitant to give it a full-throttle endorsement, but I am so close. See, right now I feel better about this company's prospects than I have in so many years. I sure wouldn't stand your way if you wanted to start buying at some of this stock. That's right. I'm saying you can buy 3M right here. Let me give you the bottom line, though. This is really important. The 3M breakup is finally complete with Solventum shares trading regular way. While Solventum has a good but not great story, the stock fortunately has a darn cheap valuation, and you have my blessing to buy this one into a week. Just remember that new spinoffs tend to be volatile for the first few months and go down. As for 3M, I know it's still risky. I know it is. But you know what? It hasn't been this attractive in years.
Buy.
You heard it.
Bye.
Let's go to work. Randy in California.
And we're back. So shorter term thing, the fear and greed came in a little bit this week to 62. We covered the AAII sentiment for the retail was elevated closer to areas where you would see some over-exuberance and a pullback. All the retail people are in the boat. So you want... It warrants caution. It doesn't necessarily, there are tendencies that you would get a pullback at those levels, but not guarantees. And that's all we do is take probabilistic and we manage that risk by sizing, et cetera. So, okay. And the National Association of Active Investment Managers, they were over 100% equity exposure. So all these things that you see at extremes. Earnings this week, we had quite a few catch up because I did the podcast early in the recent weeks and the earnings weren't out. So equal weight biotech earnings estimates for this year in the last 60 days have been revised upward by 8.6% for this year, downward by 4.23% next year. I think you're going to see those come up materially as the year rolls on. But the key is the upgrade here for the remainder of this year is positive. For the market cap weighted, which puts a bigger weight for the higher market cap, they are revised down 1.32% and down 2.84%. So, you know, down, flattish down. The growth composite, IBD 50, was very interesting. The top 30 weights earnings estimate revisions in the last 60 days were revised up 1% for this year and 6.44% for next year. So all those things that got slaughtered, decimated, taken out to the woodshed behind the barn and shot in 2022 are now coming off the mat and rising from the dead like a phoenix from the ashes. Basic materials down 5%, down 3.2%. And that's why we say, you know, trading at 21 times, you don't want to start to see too much of this stuff. And that's kind of why we're positioned for a little bit of softness in the short term until these get revised up as we get through earnings season. So let's see how that goes. Some of the data this week, you know, as you saw this morning, the jobs report was strong. Market initially didn't like it. And then Logan came to the rescue on the Fed speak. Non-farm payrolls was 303. But remember, they've been overprinting these and then revising back 100,000. Last year, they overprinted by 500,000. Let's see. Immigration is helping. These numbers, the participation rate is the most important thing I look at. This is a big deal. So this trend, which we were hopeful, is now playing out, that as all this stimulus stuff has run out, more and more people are getting back to work. And that's very, very good for the economy. And earnings, I think the key story here is you got a 21 times multiple. Expectations are 3.6% growth for the first quarter of this year, year on year. I'll take the over on that. That's revised down from December. The estimates were that Q1 was going to grow by 5.8%. I'd split the baby there. I think we probably get a 4.5 handle, maybe not blow the doors off, but slightly better than expectations. At a 21 times multiple with four and change 10-year, it's fair to fully to maybe overvalued a little bit here. So I think a pullback would be fine, and then recover and rally into year end. Let's go to some of the ask me anything questions, and then we'll wrap it up. James Jensen asks, did I miss Videocast 233 or did it not occur? No, we told you yesterday in the article that it was going to be on Friday this week. Jeremy Sachin, what happens if the Fed doesn't cut this year or next? Can BABA still work? There's a lot of chatter about how the Fed won't cut at all. Is it possible? Well, I would say this. It will be much easier for BABA to rally if the dollar weakens, which would be coincide with the Fed cutting. That said, if you recall, in the late 90s, we had one of the biggest tech rallies in the history of mankind for 5 years in a 5+% Fed funds rate environment. So there's absolute rates and there's relative rates relative to growth rates, relative to GDP growth. But leaving that aside, with the BOJ out of the market, the Fed will cut. That I can be sure of, regardless of whatever Kashkari wants to say. If you Google certain members of the FOMC and see what they have said over a period of years, you can find out whether what they say was a useful and helpful indicator for what happened next or a contraindicator for what happened next. And I'll leave it to you to reverse engineer that statement. So I am very comfortable with the idea that they may only have to cut once or twice. Zero, I think, is off the table. I think once or twice creates a mid-cycle 1995 scenario where they do that and then back off to the races. But a zero scenario, I think, is a relatively low probability at this point. Hey, Tom, thanks for all the great podcasts. I was looking to add to my BABA investment at these lower 70s, but also weigh in on some call options. Just wondering how you properly allocate funds to that you put into calls versus common shares. Is there a ratio you use? I was looking at December. Any insight is appreciated. That's proprietary to our money management clients, number one, and they're sophisticated investors. Number two, this is all opinion, not advice. Please contact your financial advisor before you do anything at all and do your own research as always, and go to hedgefundtips.com, click on terms. But we have referred to what percentage of the portfolio is long 8 to 12 companies and what percentage is allocated for long dated in the money and out of the money spreads and options and tactical hedges and shorts. But the majority is in ownership of the business. And then I'm a very small minority with a high notional value relative to that underlying stock is in different expressions of options. So, Kevin, keep it simple. You don't have to time the market. Just buy the stock and do the analysis on the company and let the stock work for you over time, and you'll be fine. But as a simple general rule of thumb, the answer to your question is if you're buying option premium, you want as long dated as humanly possible. If you are selling option premium, you probably want it as short dated as possible and benefit from the theta decay. Moving along, that's for clients. Okay. Yeah, I will call you, Micah. Sorry about that. That's reached out twice. We're going to be opening for Q2 for the smaller accounts, 1 million to 5 million at some point. We haven't decided when. We're still closed at the moment. But for the 5 and 10 plus million accounts, we're always bespoke as people reach out for that. Daniel D says, short-term thoughts on oil, please. Okay, so here's an example of opinion follows trend. That's an interesting question. Is if you knew what oil was going to do over the next 2 months, how would that help your investment decisions? And if the answer is it would have an impact, you're probably doing yourself a disservice in terms of how you're allocating capital. But since you asked the question, I'll answer it. Wow, natural gas is up. Okay. Yeah, I mean, it looks like it wants to start to, it looks like it wants to keep going for a little bit. And that will be interesting because the Fed will have to take that into consideration, but at the same time, they're going to have the other instances of servicing the debt and other factors as to their decision to make cuts. I continue to be in the camp that the earlier they cut, the less cuts they'll have to do. Like if they had cut in March, they would probably be one and done, and they wouldn't have to do anything else. The fact that they didn't, more likely than not, means at least two cuts if they go in June. If they wait past June, they could run into some trouble. So, but we'll keep an eye on this energy. You know, we've expressed our energy outlook largely through Comstock Resources as a position in the portfolio because many of the energy companies, although they'll continue, and we're bullish commodities for the next 3 to 5 years, and we've talked about the 2002 to 2007 period, we think they've priced in a decent amount of good news, the large integrated oil companies and E&P companies. We think the natural gas companies, some of them, like obviously we've owned Range for a while and Comstock, I think are just getting going. And I think it's going to be a 3 to 5 year cycle. So we're pretty excited about that. So Daniel D got that. Jonathan, what will be the true net effect of Jonathan Kuminga? What will be the true net effect of Alibaba's share buyback program? They seem to have a loose SBC, stock-based compensation. So in net effect, they are burning cash to not really do much to the share count. Yes and no. That has been a complaint of mine for some time, that they give away stock like candy. However, they also generate cash like it's going out of style, $25 billion of free cash flow a year. So the net effect, and they said it on the last earnings call, you should think about it as basically a T-bill. The shareholder yield between dividend and net buyback yield after they give away all the stock to employees is equivalent to a T-bill yield of 4 to 5%. And that's what management guided. So between dividend yield and net buyback yield, it's basically like owning a treasury. And at these levels, with the liquidation value being far greater than the market value, it is like holding a T-bill in my view. Now, a T-bill won't vacillate between $60 and $90, but a T-bill also won't have the possibility to be over $200 or over $250 a few years out, or over $300 a few years out. So I like that setup. And did I wish they gave more cash bonuses and less stock-based compensation? Yes. But there's enough net return of capital to owners to compete with the risk-free rate and have double and triple upside that I love the story. And we know the regime we covered. I would go back to last week with probably one of the most important podcasts as it relates to that new financial conditions index and our outlook for Alibaba. Go check that out. But I like the technical question you asked. We have covered that many times, but it bears repeating. Cameron. Nope, that's spam. Okay. Landon H asked, Tom, what are your thoughts on Walgreens Boots Alliance after they've declined 80% and cut their dividend? I continue to look at this, Landon, and I continue to pass. So the thing about this one, you know, Rite Aid going by the wayside, you got new competition from Amazon, but there might be a play for last man standing between Walgreens Boots and CVS are the only games in town. What I don't like is the negative free cash flow. I don't like the debt. I'd like to see the problem is, you know, if you wait for the robins to sing, it's already spring. So like if you don't own it and you wake up one day and they sold Walgreens Boots Alliance and they paid off a bunch of debt, they sold off Boots Alliance, the UK, and they use that to pay off a bunch of debt, and they start to get some traction in their business, then you're back off to the races. I think the upside's not good enough for the hair on the story. I mean, if everything goes right, maybe you have a double in a couple of years and a lot could go wrong. So for that reason, I've just passed. I think they're just higher and better uses. The good is the enemy of the better is the enemy of the best. Nish Patel asks, can you please provide your point of view on SoFi? The company seems to have overcome all the student loan noise and is showing quarter over quarter, year over year growth, but the stock is just stagnant. I've covered this one 100 times on this. It's not our cup of tea. I know Jim Cramer likes it because he's friends with Noto, and Noto helped thestreet.com go public 25 years ago and made Cramer a lot of money. You look at the revenues are growing, the margins are growing, the debt's declining. But when I look at this business, I just say, what is their competitive advantage? And I don't see any. I think it's a commodity financial services business that they're competing with thousands of banks and online platforms, and they're kind of late to the party. I hope to be proven wrong because Noto's a veteran and he seems like a great guy. This is not really, you know, my expression in financial in these fintechs is through PayPal, which has a durable moat, and they were an early mover, and I can get it at a cheap valuation and I can sleep well at night. That's where I want to be. SoFi is too speculative for me. I mean, let's just take a look at some of their stuff here so I can give you some more concrete reasons, because it's been, I don't know, it might be 2 weeks since someone asked the same question. Let's see if anything changed in 2 weeks. Nothing changed in 2 weeks. They're still burning cash like a cash machine incinerator. So that's a don't touch for me. Revenues are growing, but it literally, at this moment, it's a cash incinerator. You can bet on Manana. But they also did that raise. They're going to continue to do stuff like that. And I don't, you know, it's funny. I was talking to, my friend Mike at dinner yesterday. And I said, the problem with investing with a management that raises a lot of equity is that you buy a piece of pizza in a pie, okay? A pie of pizza has 8 slices. And you say, okay, I'm gonna put up my hard-earned capital and I'm gonna buy one of those 8 slices. And then the business grows by 3 times, okay? So you're thinking, okay, my slice is going to be worth 3 times more than I paid for it. The problem is when you have management that doesn't respect equity or is in a low quality business that's required to continually raise equity, is that even if the business triples, what the management did to you was the pie now has 80 slices and it's the same pie. So even if the pie got 3 times bigger, but meaning the business, revenues, cash flow, all that, but they sold 10 times more shares, the net effect to you is you lost money, okay? And because you're now, instead of being 1 of 8 slices or 1 of 8 shares, you're 1 of 80 shares, okay? So that's not helpful. If you divide 80 by 3, then you can see that you're in a worse situation. So while the business is quote unquote tripled, your share of the pie and the earnings and the cash flow has diminished. And that's why when I see management that has no problem with raising equity all the time and burning cash, I just steer clear. And there are exceptions. You know, people in the VC world will be like, what are you crazy? Like, businesses lose money until they don't. This thing's been going for a long time and it's not making money. So I know there's a cult following for this and I've seen cult followings for other stocks, but why don't you cult follow someone that's generating cash, that's not diluting the hell out of you and raising money all the time? And I'll leave it at that. And you know what? It's good quality people. I hope they prove me wrong. And it doesn't really matter if they prove me right or wrong. I'm in the business that I'm wonderfully content with errors of omission, taking a pass. If SoFi goes to $70, I wouldn't feel like I missed anything, because it doesn't fall in my framework of what gives me the highest probability of success. this is like a lottery ticket. And I don't play lottery. I don't gamble. I bet on things that I can be certain of, that I feel I have an edge in, and that probabilistically will make me nice amounts of money in a reasonable amount of time. This doesn't fall into that bucket, but I do appreciate the question. And Nick Saltarelli, our buddy at middaysquares.com. If you like healthy chocolate, go help Nick out. This guy is a young, aggressive entrepreneur, crushing it, getting his chocolate into Costco and going after it. He said, I know you don't like playing commodities, but if you were to make a uranium claim play, how would you do it? I mean, this is like asking me, you know, how would you work on your backhand in tennis? It's like, it's just an area I don't play in because I know the odds are against me from succeeding in tennis. So if I had to play nuclear, I would play a big defense company that if nuclear that has a great other business, so that whether the gamble on global governments being forced to accept and reinitiate nuclear works out or it doesn't work out, I still have a great business besides the nuclear free option in the business. So those are your big defense contractors that deal in nuclear. Obviously, Rolls-Royce, which we took full profits on as a multi-bagger, we would reconsider that if the market identifies what we identified, that they diluted the hell out of the shareholders and that we're basically trading 50% above all-time highs right now without 50% better performance, and the stock falls back to its dilution level, we would consider rebuying that stock as a great operating business with a nuclear kicker. But we would not make the investment on the basis of the nuclear business. It would just be a free option, which is why I don't like speculating on will nuclear be the next thing or not be the next thing. The answer is we just don't know. There was an earthquake in Connecticut. My wife texted me this morning, and you know, that's the worst thing you ever want to get is a text when you're not there to help that they're having a huge earthquake. And you know, like the house was rattling. Fortunately, you know, nothing fell off or anything and everything was fine and just, you know. But those are the type of things you see. You have one earthquake in the wrong place and a nuclear facility goes sideways, and then all of a sudden game is off. Small modular reactors are tabled once again and it's game over because people, you know, day trade long-term policy like they day trade long-term businesses. It makes no sense, but you know, behavioral finance, you have to take account for people's emotional decision, not just assume all the decisions made in the market are going to be logical. And then once you accept that, you say, how do I position myself to benefit from emotional decisions? And like we said earlier, your forced liquidation is my opportunity. So we'll leave it at that. I want to thank everyone for tuning in this week. We will be back to normal with no travel for a while, which I'm super excited about, in Connecticut and New York. Next week, same normal time, normal place. And in the meantime, make it a great one. Bye for now.